are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, July 5th, 2018. My name is Michael Brooks on a Michael Thursday. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Christy Thornton of Johns Hopkins University on the victory of Andres Manuel Lopez Obrador, AMLO, and Mexico, what that win means for Mexican politics, Mexican social movements, relations with the United States, and is it potentially even a signal for the resurgence of a global left, a global socialism? A heroic activist in New York City scaled the Statue of Liberty and unfurled an abolish ICE banner. ICE deportations. Trump has a new, basically, ransom threat. If you're willing to leave the country now, you can have the children that we kidnapped, as the Trump administration's terrorist ICE policies, family separation policies continue. Mike Pompeo is headed to North Korea to check in on the progress of that deal. Donald Trump wants somebody who looks all American for the Supreme Court and is pretty fixated on a couple of details which won't surprise you, but I don't know, maybe it would surprise some of his cultists. Even as Mike Pence prepares to meet with any potential nominees and give them the full Christian Iran test of American theocracy, Trump's trade war with China is about to reach our shores and hit our agricultural sector. And LA Times reports that workers in this town are losing their jobs, but they're still behind Donald Trump. Why? Because it's a cult. That's why. And some contractors housing migrant children are, shockingly, part of Trump's inner circle. Who'd have thunk it? And according to reports in the last couple days, Trump is wondering to cabinet members, why can't we just invade Venezuela? Apparently, trying to instigate a coup is not enough. And Brazil's Lula da Silva says, provide evidence of why the Brazilian austerity coup state, and that's my terminology, but provide evidence of why I'm in jail or I'm running for president. He still leads in polls after his imprisonment. All that and more on today's Majority Report. We are here in full effect with the gentleman of Majority. Of course, Jamie, our colleague and comrade, is at the Socialist Conference in Chicago. And Sam, not exactly a gentleman, and on the 4-day work week schedule. So the
3-day this week.
Yeah. 3 days. So I can read actuarial tables and renew. Do you see? So the gentlemen are here, the gentlemen of MR. This is some amazing footage of this activist. Her name is I should have practiced this. She's a Congolese immigrant, and her name is Teresa Okumu, and she scaled the Statue of Liberty building to unfurl a abolish ICE poster, and she wore a Rise and Resist t-shirt. And let's start with this footage of her up there. This is an NYPD helicopter monitoring the situation.
I don't know how she got up there. That is pretty impressive.
Incredibly gutsy climb. she's unfurling.
Okay, we're just it's on stage low.
This is a.
I believe one side says rise and resist.
One side of the T-shirt says rise and resist.
That's the organization. That.
And what's the other side says? Okay. And now this is footage of this is her talking with the cop. This is with the NYPD guy trying to negotiate with her as she sits there at enormous personal risk to, and I hope she has all of her paperwork in order after doing this. I mean, they're going to, if we can take, you know, from the really any modern protest movement in the United States, the repression of the state apparatus against any type of even modestly progressive activism, we got to be very concerned about this case and applaud her and her courage and these incredible images.
And support her as she goes through the system.
Yeah, yeah. We got to stay on top of this story on a regular basis because they're going to, they might really come for this woman, Teresa.
Patricia Okumu.
Patricia Okumu. We need to stay on top of this. And this is the Daily News headline, Scorn on the 4th of July. Cops, and more amazing pictures of this, cops stop Statue of Liberty from climb by women seeking independence for children jailed in Trump's camps. That's not bad, actually.
Yeah, it's better than most of the headlines.
I would imagine that the...
Cops saved the day.
Yeah.
Protect cops. Statue of Liberty's right. feet.
Yeah.
I must say, though, the only Connie arguments I've seen are people like, you put the first responders in harm's way. It's
shut up. We talked about on Tuesday on the Michael Brooks show, we went over just a sort of panoramic view for the shout out of all of the pieces of activism, a lot that we saw over this past week, or a lot of them with regards to the Trump administration's kidnap, extortion, and ransom policy with regards to the border. And, you know, of course, the broader structural and strategic white supremacy of the Trump administration and the Republican Party, and how this fits a piece of everything from voter suppression to the war on immigration, and how it's really indulging their racism and helping them build and carve the electorate they wanted. And then I went back, and a lot of people have been passing this around, and I don't know if you guys touched on this last week on the Majority Report while I was here, while I was out of town, but the piece, the New York Times editorial from 1934 by one Professor Cadbury urging Jewish people to be civil to the Nazis and suggesting that really the best way to overcome Nazism and deal with those regimes is to extend courtesy and charity to the Nazis. And, you know, and as I said at the time, if you're from that accusing me of indirectly or maybe even fairly directly comparing the Trump administration and this policy to Nazis, yes, I am exactly doing that. And number two, anybody who comes out with a first responders in harm's way type take, you are the Professor Cadbury's of today. And the very least you could do when somebody like this woman, Teresa Okumu, Teresa Okumu does something this necessary, this physically courageous, and this morally clear. At the very least, if this type of thing triggers your neurosis, makes you uncomfortable, unsettles your carefully insulated and coddled sensibilities, just keep your mouth shut. Or potentially, if you can, expand your courage and moral imagination. But if you can't do that, at the very least, don't concern troll and interfere with somebody who's demonstrated more courage than you're likely ever to. And is also about to be somebody that we're going to need to support as the system comes at them in a broader, you know, sense that we've seen from everything from the protests that greeted the Trump administration, inauguration protests, and really going back to how environmental groups have been monitored, anti-war groups have been monitored. This is a very serious issue. Or even the Jake Flores case of the ICE joke that led the Twitter satire that led to a visit from four members of Homeland Security the next day at his apartment. So I mean, at the very least, be silent than be a concerned troll appeaser.
Yeah, if we want to call that moderate, being moderate, it's time to cash that check now. And you'll have more credibility because you've been so moderate on these sorts of things, but it's not time to be that anymore.
It is not time to be. Don't be that guy. We will be right back with Christy Thornton on the Majority Report. Back to the Majority Report. I am Michael Brooks. Joining us now is Christy Thornton. She is an assistant professor at Johns Hopkins University. She just published AMLO and the State of Mexico for NACLA. Christy, you're calling from Mexico City. Thanks for being here.
Of course. Glad to be here.
So let's just re-review. We actually had a conversation probably about 10 months ago or so about Andres Manuel Lopez Obrador, his politics, where he's coming from, the type of coalition that he's built in his campaign, and now victory for the presidency. But bring people just back up to date with who he is, both from a biographical and ideological standpoint.
Yeah, so AMLO, as he's known, comes from the southern state of Tabasco. He came up through the ranks of the ruling, at the time, the only party, the Institutional Revolutionary Party. There were smaller opposition parties, but they ran Mexico as a one-party state. He was an indigenous affairs commissioner in the federal government, sort of clashed with the party. The PRI was part of an insurgency within the party to try and democratize it in the 1980s, split off and became a member of the left-leaning Party for the Democratic Revolution after the fraudulent 1988 elections, and worked within that party really until the 2012 elections, the second time he ran for president, when it became clear that that party no longer had a kind of left vision and had been taken over really by this kind of center right faction. And so as happens frequently in these kind of establishment parties in Mexico, they have these various fractions within them. The left party had been kind of taken over by center and right people. So he split off after he lost his second bid for the presidency in 2012. And formed his own party, the Movement for National Regeneration, or Morena, that it officially became a political party in 2014. And that's really the point after which he began running for president. As I said, this is his third time running for president. He's finally been successful after a fraudulent election in 2006, where he lost by less than half a percentage point, and a more decisive one in 2012, where he lost to the current president, Enrique Peña Nieto.
And where is he coming from politically? You know, I think that some of it from my reading and specifically from reading you, it seems like you could really place very specifically to Mexican politics. Then there is these, you know, generic parallels that people try to draw. Is he more like Chavez or like Lula? Most sort of ludicrous. Some people have said, well, you know, he doesn't like the media and he doesn't like elites. So obviously that's like Trump. but where, and also I should say specifically with regards to issues like, say, If we can include in this like indigenous issues in Mexico or the rights of women or LGBTQ mm-hmm. communities. So in some places, if you talk about a kind of left-leaning nationalist, that might not be a strong indication of a positive policy towards indigenous communities, right? Like particularly in a place mm-hmm. like Turkey. And then we also know that for this campaign, he had to build a very broad coalition, some with some people to the left of him, but also with an evangelical tendency as well. So where on the map, I guess, yeah, like where is he politically and what do these kind of alliances and background mean?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right that he built a kind of broad coalition for this election. It included this small fringe right-wing evangelical party called Encuentro Social, Social Encounter. They are, you know, sort of vehemently anti-abortion, gay marriage, women's rights. And so that was really problematic for a lot of people on the left. The idea, I think, from his campaign was that that party has some power in some places where his formation, Morena, was less likely to win. They remain a fringe party. And so within his governing coalition, I think they'll be a very small part. But people are right to sort of give pause to that. One important thing about the rights of women in this campaign is that AMLO's cabinet and going forward, actually the entire Congress will have gender parity. So 50-50 women and men. López Obrador was very clear from the beginning that he would make half of his cabinet women. And there is a really incredible range of very talented women who have joined his team and will be part of his cabinet. The woman running who actually won the mayorship of Mexico City from his party, Claudia Sheinbaum, is also a Morena candidate, also from this formation. With regard to sort of where it fits on a political spectrum, you're right that people have drawn all sorts of crazy comparisons. And I think it just shows the sort of lack of utility of the idea of lumping things together as populism when you could put Hugo Chavez and Donald Trump in the same basket in that way. There is a sense that politics in Mexico is kind of exceptional. Trends that have happened in larger senses in Latin America have not happened here throughout history, and there's always been a kind of Mexican exceptionalism. So there is some sense in which AMLO comes from a kind of particular Mexican tradition that is believing in the use of the state for a kind of distributive project that is about sort of a reconciliation between business classes, capitalist interests, but making sure to keep in mind and keep front and center the needs of the working class and the poor and the indigenous people. So in this way, he draws from a kind of long tradition of Mexican leftism that is not so much linked to larger international tendencies. That said, I think what we saw in the campaign and what we know from how he governed when he was the mayor of Mexico City is that he's very pragmatic. He's not at all an ideologue. And that's something that makes the comparisons with Hugo Chavez really strange, because he does not have this kind of strong ideological bent that really marked so much the turn toward socialism under Hugo Chavez and that was so important for Chavez's project. So I think we can expect to see him govern pragmatically. I think that there, within his cabinet and within his movement, there are people who are very strongly to the left and who already have said to me that they will be pushing from within the governing coalition to make sure to that the right-wing tendencies, that is this small evangelical party, his alliances with some members of the business class, that the left project that they see is not alienated by those tendencies. There are important businessmen, for instance, who've come into the coalition. And so it has been a very pragmatic campaign. He's a very pragmatic politician.
Yeah, I want to tease out that business connection, and I have a read on it, and I want to run it by you. Mm-hmm. It seems like that partially, like what he's done, because he also, it seems in some ways the comparisons to Lula maybe make some sense, although it's a really different context, and Lula obviously, it seems like they have really different kind of personalities and styles. Mm. And Obrador talked a lot about corruption, and one area where I guess people have focused on that, oh, he's not providing enough details, or he isn't saying the sort of tough choices you have to make. And I just have no way of judging that. I don't know the numbers, obviously. But he's kind of suggested that if we can get rid of systemic corruption in the Mexican state, that the freed up capital of that will be a lot of what will both fund the expansion of, you know, the social justice, welfare state. And then at the same time, as you say, he doesn't have an anti-capitalist position at all, per se. Right. We can clean up corruption, and then capitalism can function properly. And it seems like there is a contingent of business guys who have been drawn to him. And I'll draw like a South Africa comparison. It's a really different context, obviously. But, you know, you have Cyril Ramaphosa in power now, taking over from Zuma, and a big part of it is just can we have a capitalism that fits the rules of like what a 21st century more developed normalized place is supposed to look like versus complete state capture and corruption. So I guess my question is like, is that the synthesis that he's trying to draw? Like, you normalize capitalism and then you redistribute the fruits. And then number two, did the PRI, and particularly in its, you know, current iteration under Peña Nieto, did that sort of level of corruption and clientelism reach like an even unparalleled level for like modern Mexico?
Yeah, so those are both really good questions. I think your sort of general diagnosis of the situation is right, in that López Obrador sort of joins a long tradition of kind of state developmentalists in Latin America. And that is to say, he comes from a tradition of people who want to use the capitalist apparatus, right? Like the idea of capitalist development to secure a larger redistributive project. So they want the state to be the mediator between the poor and the working classes and the capitalist class. And they think that they can use the state to sort of create structures to control and funnel the sort of outcomes of capitalist development. There's very much a sense that Mexico should be more developed, should have a more highly functioning higher levels of growth capitalist apparatus than it does, right? Mexico joined the OECD after NAFTA. So the idea is that it's if there can be created a kind of state apparatus that can harness the productive capacity of Mexico's insertion into the global economy and create a kind of distributive apparatus to ensure that the sort of spoils of that are more equally distributed. I think that that's absolutely the kind of vision that he has. It is not a socialist, revolutionary, communist platform in any sense. And so I think that that is how we will continue to see his cabinet develop and his governance develop. With regard to the kind of corruption here in Mexico and how it affected capitalist development here, I think it's fair to say that it has disrupted the kind of normal flow of how you might expect things to work. And so there is a sense from particular parts of the capitalist class here in Mexico, for instance, the businessman who will likely be AMLO's chief of staff is an important kind of investment banker, investor named Alfonso Romo. And he has long been an incredibly important mover and shaker within the kind of industrial and banking class here in Mexico. He looks to the López Obrador project precisely with the idea that it might root out the corruption and make business practice sort of more normal here in Mexico. Under the Peña Nieto administration, not only were levels of corruption at unprecedented levels, and that made Peña Nieto's approval ratings spectacularly low. He reached 12% approval rating in 2017. It meant that, you know, doing business here, the thing that Peña Nieto was supposed to bring was renewed business confidence. Mm. I don't know if your listeners will remember that when he was elected in 2012, he appeared on the cover of Time magazine with the headline "Saving Mexico," and the idea was supposed to be that Peña Nieto was supposed to bring back business confidence. The international investor class was supposed to be flocking back to Mexico, and in the main, we have not seen that. And that has been because of corruption and also because of insecurity, because of the continued prosecution of the drug war here and the way in which that has made violence really explode. So under this administration in the past 5 years, we have really seen a kind of lack of stability and in that way, business confidence, right? The one thing that the kind of neoliberal leader is supposed to bring back to the country has been a massive failure under Peña Nieto.
Right. So then, and 12% sad.
Really, the least popular government in modern Mexican history. I mean, the repudiation is total. It's really incredible to think about. Until 2000, you know, less than two decades ago, this was a single-party state where everything happened through the PRI. And in this election in 2018, the PRI's presidential candidate won not a single federal electoral district. Wow. It was a complete and total repudiation of the PRI. And so there's long been a kind of a chant that people use in the streets and protests here where they chant, "Mexico sin PRI," Mexico without the PRI, the idea that, you know, you need to remove the PRI to get rid of the corruption. And really in this election, we have seen the voters take a massive step in that direction to really remove the power of this party that governed Mexico unopposed for 70 years.
Yeah, I want to get to like the broader victories of Morena in a second. But if okay, so the PRI has lost and there are some members of the business sector that at the very least can partially support at least a sort of some aspects of an anti-corruption effort. But that being said, and before we even get to the United States, if there is a real reform agenda in Mexico, who does that immediately smack up against, both in terms of the business sector and also, you know, and the cartels? I mean, what does that look like? If the first step is remove the PRI electorally, and now we have to get into like Mexico's deep state, which I wish we could really retire that phrase, but it probably is the right phrase in this instance. What does that look like in terms of the types of moves he'd have to make and the pushback he can expect?
Mm-hmm. So I think that's really important. The woman who will take over as what is essentially a position akin to the comptroller general, the person who will be in charge of sort of how all of the federal money and the functioning of the federal government, is a woman named Irma Irendera Sandoval. She is a tireless fighter, comes from a very left-wing family in the southern state of Guerrero, and it is basically her job moving forward to begin to review how the federal government spends its money, where it goes, and where that corruption is. And so when you saw the biggest pushback, I really think during the campaign from the business classes, from kind of entrenched structures of political power, was really from people who know that their links into illicit money, ghost contracts, no-show jobs, those kinds of things are on the chopping block in the López Obrador administration. So members of the business class who have long benefited from the corrupt way that politics works, if that is no longer the case and Morena has taken either five or six, we'll have final results soon of the nine open governorships here in Mexico. If there is no longer this kind of link into the corrupt structures of the state via the PRI or the center-right PAN, the National Action Party, all of a sudden that kind of that your ability to get money from the federal government through that is cut off. And so I think a lot of the opposition we saw was precisely people who knew that their ability to kind of siphon money off in that way will be threatened in this administration. So that, I mean, it's a job. Irma is a friend. I don't envy her the job that goes ahead of her now under the López Obrador administration. Obviously, Mexico has a massive government, it has a massive budget, and it has a massive amount of federal spending. And so the review of that in the beginning of sort of rooting out, figuring out where the corrupt spending has been happening. And really here in Mexico, it's like, once a week, there is a new massive scandal where you find out that there has been a contract awarded to some shadow company and it has gotten hundreds of millions of dollars over years through government spending. So there is a tremendous amount of that kind of corrupt government spending to be rooted out. And that will really be the first task of the López Obrador administration, because, as you mentioned, that is one of the main ways they intend to reorient government spending toward social programs and the kind of protection for the poor that have been eroded under the Peña Nieto administration.
What about the cartel aspect of this? I mean, is that over exaggerated in U.S. media? Where, like, certainly did seem like they were definitely connected to the Peña Nieto government. They have connections in local politics, and in some areas, the security situation is really real. What is his sort of rhetoric on that? And I guess more broadly, maybe we could start opening into, you know, it's like at some point a Mexican president's going to need to confront a U.S. president on cartel policy and the drug war. Maybe, you know, as Derek Davison was saying on my show, maybe AMLO's the one to have that conversation. Trump is almost certainly not the one to hear it. But let's get to that.
Yeah. So this is a really difficult sort of conjunctural moment, right? We finally have a president coming into power in Mexico since the war on drugs and organized crime, as it's called here in Mexico, really began 10 years ago, 2007, 2008, under former President Felipe Calderon of the right-wing National Action Party. His approach was to send the military into the streets to begin to attack the cartels using military force. And he really did launch a war. It was a literal war with tanks and guns and helicopters and soldiers. And that is why you have seen the violence really skyrocket over this last decade. You know, according to some statistics, and this is disputed by some historians, but last year may have been the most violent year in Mexican history, the highest number of murders and violent crimes. So that aspect of the drug war is something that AMLO has said he wants to reverse. He wants to take the military out of fighting this war. He wants to do things like provide scholarships for young people so that they don't enter the drug trade to begin with. He talks a lot about sort of trying to get young people and people who've been swept into the drug trade because of lack of other kinds of economic opportunity out of it. So he wants to offer these scholarships and kind of offer amnesty to low-level people involved in the cartels who have not been involved in violent crime, really try to reorient that social structure that provides the base of support, the kind of base through which the cartels work. The question of what will happen at the kind of higher levels in the fight against the cartels is a really difficult one, because over this last decade, what this war on drugs and organized crime has done is pursue what's known in how these things work as the kingpin strategy, right? Mm-hmm. That is, take out the heads of these cartels.
Right.
And so that's why we have El Chapo Guzman in federal prison in New York. And we've seen the arrest of a number of these kind of high level people in these various cartels. And what that has led to over the last decade is really a fracturing of power within that sector. So it used to be that there were kind of centralized understandings of power. And we've seen this throughout history in all kinds of mafia history, right? When you take out the guy at the top, the two guys who are underneath begin to battle for power. And then right. there's a competition within that cartel and it fractures. So we've seen that. And we've seen new formations sort of split off from existing cartels and come out. And some of these new formations are much more violent, much less willing to play by the old rules, the kind of mafia rules that used to govern things. You don't go after families. You don't go after children. Like some of the new cartel formations like Jalisco New Generation are just spectacularly violent, right? And don't have this kind of mafia code that used to govern how these things work. In single party rule under the PRI, there was drug trafficking, there were drug cartels, but everything was sort of contained through parallel and intersecting power structures in the political system under the PRI and in the cartels themselves. And since we have this kind of ironic and sad situation where the opening to electoral democracy here in Mexico, the breaking of the monopoly of power of the PRI, has happened at the same time as the kind of fracturing of these drug cartels. And so the existing structures of power for controlling the cartel violence no longer exist. So that is a serious challenge that faces López Obrador. Getting the military off the streets, sort of demilitarizing and trying to erode the social base for people to join these organizations will be incredibly important. But without a doubt, he's going to confront the Trump administration, which we've seen at home has tried to really return to a much more punitive and militarized understanding of the drug war than was the, you know, sort of the loose trend under the Obama administration. There's kind of a loose international trend that says, you know, we know militarization in the drug war over the last 40 years hasn't worked. And Trump has, you know, put the brakes completely on that. Under Attorney General Jeff Sessions, they just want to return to lock them all up, throw away the key, kill them if you have to. And so I think that that will be a serious confrontation, what to do about security policy and the drug problem, together with the migration issue, will be some of the big things that lead to confrontation between the Trump administration and the Lopez Obrador administration.
Yeah, that makes total sense. Maybe we could elaborate that just for a minute. There's migration, there's drugs, which we already talked about. There's the renegotiations of NAFTA actually happening. And also the fact that, you know, we talked about this last time as well, that leading up into, you know, AMLO's election, there's obviously the United States. I mean, at the very least, they're okay with what's happening in Brazil. There's definitely a lot of aggression towards Venezuela.
Yep.
And now, you know, obviously there's the perception that this is a left takeover in Mexico. So maybe just spell it out even beyond, you know, the drug component, like what you see happening with regards to that relationship under AMLO and under the Trump administration.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the interesting things about Trump is that he kind of scrambles the traditional ways in which, you know, a kind of business class dominated Republican Party, free trade, that has existed as the kind of consensus and has pulled, you know, the Democratic Party far over to the right for the last 30 years. He sort of scrambles some of that. And so I don't know how much he understands the kind of Trump himself understands the kind of left right question when it comes to Latin American politics in this way. But as you said, those three areas, drugs, trade, and migration, those are three areas where Mexico really has some cards to play vis-a-vis its relationship with the United States. So, you know, with regard to the drug war, this pulling back of the militarization could be very important. Since 2008, the United States and Mexican government have participated together in this thing called the Merida Initiative, which has sent $3 billion in military aid, training, and equipment to Mexico for the fighting of the drug war. So if Lopez Obrador says that he wants to no longer participate in the Merida Initiative, that not only has kind of political consequences, it has political economic consequences in that defense contractors in the United States have been the main beneficiaries of the Merida Initiative, right? That $3 billion has gone to like Raytheon and General Dynamic and the U.S. military. It hasn't gone to the Mexican government, right? So deciding to sort of scale back the military, the security cooperation could have real consequences, not just for the relation, but sort of political economically within the United States. On trade, you know, Lopez Obrador has said that he wants, especially within the renegotiation of NAFTA, and he's already putting his people in those teams, right? He has said, my negotiators need to be part of this. Any conversations that are happening now in this kind of lame duck period between now and when he takes office on December 1st, that members of his cabinet need to be involved, that he's going to have people there. So we should expect to see him play an important role in the continuing and sort of very difficult NAFTA negotiations ongoing. What he has said is, look, the United States subsidizes its farmers. The United States farmer subsidy, you know, through the Farm Bill, massive subsidies, for instance, for corn and soy and these kinds of agribusiness that have really devastated the Mexican agricultural sector. And he said, we want to create opportunities for Mexican farmers that haven't existed since the advent of NAFTA. So we can expect him to try and take up some of the same kinds of protections for his own farmers, for his own agricultural sector, as the United States does there. And so that, I think, will be an important thing that happens in NAFTA. Trump's understanding of what's going on in NAFTA is, again,
highly specific and super detailed. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Right. And like a little questionable. He sent out a tweet this week that said something about how he was going to levy tariffs on Mexican car makers. And I was thinking to myself, like, yeah, when you're out in the streets in the United States, you see tons of Mexican brands of cars driving around, right? It's like they're U.S. car makers who manufacture parts here in Mexico. And so if he puts a tariff on that, he puts a tariff on General Motors, right? So his understanding of what's going on there vis-a-vis those trade negotiations is a little questionable. Obviously, the people who are actually doing the negotiations understand that much more clearly. And so we can expect to see Lopez Obrador exerting some influence there even before he takes office on December 1st. And then finally, the question of migration is an incredibly important one. Lopez Obrador has said that he will basically stop a policy that has been in place since the Obama administration, where the Mexican government agreed to militarize its southern border, with Guatemala as sort of a proxy for the United States, right? So the Mexican government deploys its military massively to the southern border to try to apprehend and turn away Central American migrants who are trying to cross from Guatemalan territory into Mexican territory to eventually get to the United States. López Obrador has literally called that the U.S.'s dirty work and says he no longer wants to do the dirty work, wants to move the his focus on migration up to the northern border and to respect the rights of migrants who are trying to cross Mexican national territory. So that is an area, obviously, with Trump's overheated rhetoric and xenophobic nationalist approach to migration, where I think we can expect to see a real confrontation between the López Obrador administration, which no longer wants to act as a proxy for the U.S. So I think that that is a fight that's definitely to come.
I'd like to take that clip of Obrador saying that and lock John Oliver in a room and just have that played on repeat.
Precisely. Like,
yeah. The final question I have for you is, you touched on this earlier, Morena performed really, really well across the board. It wasn't just winning the presidency. And then also there are social movements in Mexico that are on the streets and in civil society and pushing the boundaries of rights and politics and redistribution and so on. And you talk to people who said that they already are going in, obviously supporting AMLO, but with the intention of fighting, you know, rigorously for that sort of left position. And I just, maybe you could just elaborate on the context going forward for that kind of pressure, like the how powerful the stakeholdership is of left factions to help kind of steer the ship in the right way.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really interesting question. So as you said, Morena not only won the presidency, they will have majorities in both houses of Congress. The entire legislature was up for election, and Morena candidates won majorities in both the Senate and the House of Deputies, the lower house. They took important governorships all over the country, and then lots of these kind of state and municipal level offices as well. So there is really this big base of party power for López Obrador, which is really incredible. He created this party in 2014. It has only existed for a couple of years. But as I said, the kind of repudiation of politics as it has existed has shown that there is a lot of just a lot of backing for the vision that López Obrador and this party have put forward. Over the course of this administration, especially under Peña Nieto, there have been these massive mobilizations of civil society, of activist groups, because of the sort of scale and severity of some of the crises that we've seen. So economic crises, a near doubling of the price of gasoline happened here in Mexico after an energy reform, a neoliberal energy reform that was supposed to bring down the price of oil and gas for Mexican consumers. And in fact, precisely the opposite happened. Human rights crises, like the disappearance of those 43 students from the Ayotzinapa Normal School and the government's handling of that. So we've seen these kind of massive mobilizations happen over and over and over during the Peña Nieto administration. And Morena has been a kind of part of that formation. They have supported some of those mobilizations and really taken advantage of some of that social movement energy. So I would expect to see, you know, talking to people from within the cabinet and from within the party who are, you know, deeply committed leftists coming out of long radical traditions in Mexico, I would expect to see those people working very hard to kind of keep up that level of social movement mobilization to ensure that there is the kind of, that the electoral mandate that we saw, 53% of the vote, which is really unprecedented in this era of, since the Democratic opening, that there is a kind of social movement base to that. I will expect to see that continuing going forward and expect to see it both from within and from within without the Morena and the state structure in general.
Christy Thornton is an assistant professor at Johns Hopkins University. I really appreciate your time as always, Christy, from Mexico City. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
All right, guys, we are going to get to the fun half shortly. First of all, is Jamie's not calling? Okay.
Tomorrow.
Okay. Tomorrow with a live update from the Socialist Conference. Of course, check out The Antifada on iTunes or Patreon, Jamie and Sean's pod. They'll have updates from it. Matt, what is the state of Literary Hangover.
New episode coming out on Saturday, Sleepy Hollow. It's sort of, if you enjoyed the Rip Van Winkle one, it's similar, well, the same author. And you can see that.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yep, Washington Irving.
Oh, cool.
He's like, I think of him as sort of the Ricky Gervais, like, and Sleepy Hollow and Rip Van Winkle are sort of his office and extras. And then he didn't really do a whole lot interesting after that.
That's interesting. Extras is underrated.
It is. I think it's good.
Ricky Gervais is something else because there is probably nobody else that I don't like. Find them just at this point, basically just a public nuisance. Don't like his stand-up routines. And legitimately, like The Office, I think arguably the best sitcom ever made. I think Extras is super underrated and very funny. And I thought his podcast was good. It's very weird to have somebody that you think is so good end up annoying you so much.
And do three solid things that sort of...
Yeah, like he had a track record. It wasn't a one-hit wonder. Like the guy's definitely very talented.
Usually people as annoying as sort of, and sort of mediocre as him as sort of he appears on social media.
I guess it's just stand-up and social media.
He shouldn't do stand-up.
He's not a stand-up, and you don't need to be a stand-up to be a great, talented comic.
But yeah, I'm putting the episodes on YouTube now, so a Literary Hangover, you can find those there.
Sweet. Of course, you can become a member of the Majority Report at majority.fm/become a member or check out justcoffee.coop, Majority Report Coffee, Fair Trade Tea, Coffee, and Chocolate. On the Michael Brooks Show on this past Tuesday, we had on Bree Joy Gray to break down how Alexandria...
Ocasio-Cortez.
Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez won. And push back against the essentialist narratives being pushed on how she won. Jake Flores was in studio. We talked about ICE, satire. And I did a dissection of John Oliver's just embarrassing Mexican election commentary on AMLO, as well as his failures on Venezuela. This Sunday, an illicit history of U.S. interventions in Latin America for patrons. Woke Bros is back on Friday with Waz and I. And of course, you get the post game, you get everything, a lot of content at patreon.com/TMBS. We're also at 280 reviews on iTunes for TMBS. So if you want to help push the momentum that way. And on the 17th, which is on next week, Harvey Kay's in studio. On the 17th, Matt Taibbi's in studio for TMBS. And that is also going to be the same day that we launch the Michael Brooks Show YouTube channel. So thanks, everybody, for that. Patreon.com/TMBS. 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920. We'll see you in the fun half.
You are...